Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Ugh, fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
That bass kicked in, so you better be ready. It's time for DLC, your downloadable content for the week. DLC delivered the way it's meant to be, completely free. And that's thanks to our sponsor this week, Harry's. They made that possible, bringing DLC to you absolutely free. DLC, of course, the show all about gaming in its many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. And also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I am your host, Jeff 2Ns1T Kanata, and I'm joined as always by my friend slash co-host slash nemesis. The guy who still has a voice, only because he couldn't join me on my bachelor party weekend, Christian Spicer. Welcome, Christian.
Thank you. Happy belated birthday to you, Jeff Kanata. And I'm sorry I missed the bachelor party, but it sounds like everything went swimmingly.
It was amazing, and I apologize to everyone listening that my voice is weak and gravelly, but I did a lot of screaming this weekend. I went whitewater rafting. I did very little gaming and a lot of screaming. The sirens are coming to get me. Sirens are coming to get me because it was that dangerous. DLC is, of course, your downloadable Kanata, your downloadable Christian. But this week, we're excited because DLC stands for Dynamite's leader and co-founder. Because we've got the creative director from Dynamite, the studio behind the upcoming PlayStation exclusive title, Counter Spy, Mr. David Nottingham. Welcome, David.
Hello. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Yeah, regular listeners of the show will remember we had David on briefly during E3 week. He called in and talked about his experience showing off Counter Spy at E3. But we're excited to have you on as a full-on guest this week and do the whole treatment. But we definitely still want to hear a little bit about your game. Remind everybody what that is and when it's coming out.
Absolutely. So Counter Spy is a side-scrolling action espionage game with a healthy dose of stealth gameplay. It's coming out for PlayStation 4, PlayStation 3, and I know Christian will be happy. It's also coming out on Vita.
What?
That's right. It's coming out on the 19th of August, so it's part of Sony's PlayStation Play program, so they're releasing one game a week. So Rogue Legacy came out last week, so we come out on the 19th. I think these are my sirens, guys. Are you hearing that?
It sounds like you're in the middle of a demilitarized zone. Is everything okay where you are?
So let me tell you a little bit about where Dynamite is located. So we're in San Francisco. We're on Market Street, and we're on a stretch of Market Street that is kind of the intersection of like old and new, right? So you know that there's been a lot of technology explosions and people moving into the city and big companies. So like Twitter's a few blocks away from us. But there's also sort of right downtown, there's this epicenter of the city that has more of the kind of like older aspects of the city. And, you know, there's a few crazy people around and things like that. And, you know, it's sort of all part of the city's color, but it does mean that we have kind of police action that tends to happen outside on a fairly, not daily, but at least weekly And there's a lot of sort of live theater that happens outside our doors.
That's a great way of putting it. I like that. you've been in game development for a long time with AAA titles and smaller titles and kind of gone back and forth. Tell us a little bit about how you got into game development and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, so I'm going to really age myself the more I talk about this. but basically, I guess sort of my first job in the games industry was coming out of college. And I hadn't really thought that I would ever have a career in the games industry per se. I definitely, I was a huge gamer as a kid. I played, so the Commodore 64 was my gaming machine back in the day. So right there, that you can start doing some math around the years. but that was sort of mid to late 80s. I was hugely into that. And I gamed a lot when I was going to college still. And that was when sort of the PC was starting to come up with games like Doom and the Amiga. God, do you guys remember the Commodore Amiga?
Oh yeah, I wanted one of those so badly, and I never got one. Man. My dad said, "No, we're a PC family. We're sticking with PCs." And I was like, "But I want the Amiga so bad."
Yeah, that was similar for me. Like, I totally coveted that, and my parents. I guess being of that generation where your parents are like, "What are these computers? These are terrible things you're bringing home, and you're playing games on them all the time, and you're not going out and playing in the backyard and, you know, playing with a ball and stick and all these type of things." So my parents tried everything they could to stop me from playing video games.
Son, we're worried about you. You haven't broken any windows or gotten any girls pregnant? Or
it's like, no, Mom, I'm totally breaking windows. Windows breaks all the time.
I kind of was doing that stuff too, but just, let me think. I wasn't a programmer. So back then it was like people who made games were there was just basically programmers and they made the entire game, right? Like one or two people. And I always, I was like super art nerd. Always drawing. I was kind of a book nerd too, and I was always escaping into fancy worlds and I guess creating a lot of mystery worlds and stuff in my head. So one thing I used to do that sort of maybe an early clue of my future as a game designer was I had Lego as a kid, and I used to build these like Lego level, almost like mazes. And then I would go out into the backyard and catch ants. And I would put ants in the mazes. And then I would get like a spider and put it in the maze. So it was almost like my little real world Dungeons and Dragons for the ants. And then I basically want to see if the ant could navigate his way out of the maze.
Did he ever level up?
No, I didn't give him any tools to level up. I think I might have put some like crumbs in or something. Like, hey, here's some health. I don't know. Probably not the worst thing you can do with ants as a kid. I think, you know, like at least I wasn't pouring gasoline down there.
Right.
But this is kind of convoluted. But basically, I went to college. I pursued an art career, studied photography, came out of college, knew I didn't want to be a photographer, and had that sort of what do I do with my life moment. A friend of mine told me about this job to go start work as a games tester at this company in the UK. And they were testing games by the Bitmap Brothers and by Sensible Software. And these were kind of like the indie rock stars of the UK during that time, right? Like they were sort of companies that had a very strong identity that you really kind of loved. So Bitmap Brothers made Chaos Engine. Sensible Software made a bunch of games like Cannon Fodder that were really big on the Amiga. And I was huge fans of those games. So that was my first like, wait, you can get paid for this? And so, I mean, that's basically how I got into it.
And you worked for LucasArts, right? And were involved with some of their memorable games.
So over the years, the industry sort of got bigger and bigger and bigger. I came in just before the first PlayStation came out. So it was really at the dawn of what has become the games industry today. And the teams got bigger and bigger. I worked at GT Interactive, which was the publisher of Doom and Duke Nukem. Then I went to join Rockstar Games. That was in 99. And that was working on originally Grand Theft Auto 2. There were a bunch of other games that had come out. So Grand Theft Auto 3 hadn't come out yet. So Rockstar was really just a really small kind of New York-based company. It was like literally about 12 people there.
Wow.
That's crazy.
But it was, you know, if you can think to how the industry was before, you know, I was right at that age in my mid-20s where I was one of those people that are still gaming as an adult, right? And so you'd be working in the industry and bumping up against all these perceptions of people going, you know, games are for kids. Games are for kids. It's Nintendo. It's, you know, and we were thinking like, well, where are the games for us? You know, where's the games we want to play? And I met with Sam Hauser, who's the president, and we just totally connected because we were about the same age. And he was just like, had this laser focused vision about kind of what games could be. So that was a really awesome experience and time to be a part of something that just really kind of put a dent in the industry, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's very cool.
Yeah,
and now you're working on a much smaller game again, kind of a throwback to how you started, huh? It's a smaller team, but really high quality looking. Talk a little bit about your desire to work within a smaller team.
Yeah, so I think it just comes down to, you know, the industry has got so big over so many years, and there's so many moving parts to make a big AAA game. You need like 100, 200 people all moving in unison. And I'd been dreaming. I always thought, was thinking of my own worlds and mythologies and things like that, and experiences that I wanted to create through the medium of video games. And as the industry grows, it's like gets harder and harder. Like those opportunities for people who are individuals to kind of lead a team and create something, you know, it's a smaller and smaller group of people that can do that. Just because there's only so many games that are going to get funded. And I actually got that opportunity. That was why I was hired at LucasArts. This was when they were developing The Force Unleashed. And they had another team that was doing an Indiana Jones game at the time. Right. But at that time, they'd been wanting to create big, ambitious new IP as well. This was something that George himself, I'm going to sound really pretentious here because I'll just call him George.
Just call him George.
If I say George Lucas, I always sound uncomfortable too because it's like, yeah, Uncle George. I mean, it's not like we're hanging out at the ranch together, swapping stories. But, you know, he's a huge figure.
Could you hold on for 1 second? George just called me. Hey, George, what's up, buddy? And, no, yeah, I'm talking to your friend. Yeah, anyway. Okay, sorry. I'll talk to you later. Bye, Jay. Well, bye, G.
Bye. It's GL. GL. They've been trying for a long time to get a new IP off the ground. And, it's something that I've been thinking so much about, like how to create new worlds. And I was so passionate about it that I kind of somehow convinced them to kind of hire me and put me in charge of a team and essentially try and build something that could kind of stand alongside Star Wars and Indiana Jones, right, as an IP for the studio. So
wow. just another Wednesday.
No pressure. Like, hey, why don't you just go do this?
So, well, that's awesome. That's awesome.
It was awesome, and it was totally terrifying. And all of a sudden, I came into work, and there was a group of guys that were already there, that I were sort of waiting for me and looking for me to sort of lead them, right? And I'm just like, I'm going to try not to swear here. I don't know what the F I'm doing. I'm sort of making it up as I go along. But I was very upfront with the team about that. Like, I said, look, guys, you know, this is awesome. I really want to make something amazing, and I want to make it with you. And I sort of have known enough about me over the years that I know, like, I'm not the type of person that's like the sort of autocratic, like, I'm going to shout at everyone and tell them, this is where we're going. Get over that hill. Come on. You know, I'm much more the person that's going to sit back and go, all right, hey, so Christian, what do you think about so-and-so? And Jeff, what do you think we should do about this? And then, like, let other people kind of step up and contribute. And then sort of I'm sort of good at taking all that in and then funneling it into a direction. It was a real, that experience at LucasArts, I learned a lot. Like, I learned a lot managing the big team and the big ambitious project. I guess I really grew up a lot on that project, because I'd worked on a lot of small projects, and I'd also played very small parts on bigger projects, but it was the first time really having that responsibility.
Wow, that's cool.
So it was cool, but then what happened was, if people are familiar with the sort of history of LucasArts, particularly during that period, there was like a whole 10-year period where it felt like LucasArts would sort of go from like, hey, we're doing Star Wars. Here's more Star Wars than you want. Hey, ready for more Star Wars? Here's Star Wars.
We're back to that era, by the way.
Did you like racing games? Here's Star Wars with racing. You know, like, it's just, and then they would go through this phase of like, no, we create amazing IP and we have this huge legacy. And I'd sort of come in off of the back of that. But then there was a big sort of executive shuffle at the company, and the board at Lucasfilm decided they wanted to take a different direction. And they brought in a new guy as president and basically wanted to control a lot of the costs for development and have a much more sort of predictable revenue stream. And the thing is, it's really hard to argue that when you have Star Wars. It's like, I mean, that there's everything else in the world and there's Star right. Wars, right?
Yeah,
when
for
it
sure.
comes to IP yeah. and like every generation has a version of Star Wars that they love. You know, for people of a certain age, it's the original trilogy.
And then there's other people who are wrong.
Right. But believe it or not. Right? Okay, well, that's a longer conversation. But
well, we're excited to have someone with as much experience as you've had in the industry on the show to talk about everything. So we should probably move into the meat of the show, which is, of course, Story of the Week.
Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week, it's the Story of the Week.
As you know, Story of the Week is the part of the show where we try to convince one another of the most important gaming news stories that have happened this week. You, as a listener, can submit stories for us to consider for this segment by using the hashtag DLCSOTW on Twitter. That's DLCSOTW. Or visiting our subreddit over at reddit.com/r/5x5DLC. David, I am curious as to what you think the most important story that happened was this week.
Oh, I get to pick, huh?
Yeah, you get first pick.
Oh, no. I can talk about a story. Well, let's talk about, the EA subscription service.
Yeah, that's a pretty big one. That was submitted by a number of people, including at @Joe_McAllister. And that, I think, surprised a lot of people that EA was being so bold as to introduce this EA Access program, which it turns out looks like it's going to be exclusive to the Xbox One console. It's going to cost you $5 a month or $30 a year, and you get a selection of back catalog EA games. It's not super back catalog. It looks like it's going to be at least the first few titles in the beta program are going to be FIFA 14, Madden NFL 25, Peggle 2, and Battlefield 4. So it's just sort of one generation removed of each of their big flagship titles. And they're also going to offer you a 10% discount on purchases of digital content for the newer versions of those games and all EA content, including Dragon Age. So it looks like a pretty interesting deal. What's your take on this, David?
I was really interested on your guys' take on it. just to sort of flip it back around on you.
Well,
can I do that?
Sure. My feeling is this is a really interesting half step toward what I feel like they really want to do. It's them going, hey, we get to monetize content that's sort of gotten to the end of its long tail, and we're about to iterate on all these titles, and we're about to sell people the new version of almost every one of these. And is there a way to squeeze money out of the older versions and create an infrastructure, create an ecosystem that EA gamers want to be a part of? And then maybe at some point we can move to the full step version of this, which is, hey, pay us a subscription to new games. And I don't think that's going to be a $5 version. I think there's going to be this is totally a guess, but I'm guessing this $5 version is the gateway drug to getting you to the $20, $30 a month version of EA access.
Wow.
That is the full Madden new roster updates, full FIFA new roster updates, full Battlefield new map downloads version of this system.
I'm going to say no. I mean, I think it's a very bold prediction. I don't think EA will go that way. I think this will stay as a place that you're talking about first, Jeff, to get revenue off of older content and maybe get that, you know, as dumb as terms are, that casual gamer that, you know, which is weird because it's a subscription service to get a casual sports gamer. But I think maybe they're viewing it as a gateway drug to then sell the standalone retail version of that year's new game, right? Where this, you know, you bide the time with this, and then when Madden 15 drops, you get your 10% discount. And so it's kind of this weird thing, right, where you're already spending the money, but you think to yourself, well, if I now buy two more EA games this year, whatever it is, it's almost like the subscription pays for itself with that 10% discount. Or I had friends talking about, and I don't know if they'll let you do this to quote unquote game it this way, but signing up for that for 1 month for $5 right when Madden comes out, and then you basically spend the money and get the month is kind of a wash in terms of costs or whatever. But I don't
know. What
I
does
think
that get
story,
you? I mean, you save 10%, which is basically $5. And
right.
you spent $5. You're not really gaming the system any.
Well, you're getting that month of EA access, quote unquote, for free if you were going to buy Madden anyway.
So, yeah, I see that.
I can give you, so as a gamer, when it first came out, I initially was kind of really excited because I thought about how, you know, every year it's like there's a new FIFA, there's a new Madden. And I thought, oh, well, that would be awesome, right? Like I would pay a monthly subscription just to be kind of like the EA Sports subscription pack. If it meant I never had to go out and spend another $60 on a game. But when I realized it wasn't that you're only getting the older versions, then I guess I got a little confused. Like, I didn't really know who this was necessarily targeted at.
Yeah.
Totally.
You know, because I think like FIFA 14 or Madden NFL 25, like how many people would want to pay an ongoing subscription for access to an out-of-date roster? When you can pretty much buy the out-of-date games in the store, right, for a much lower price, certainly much lower than what you'd be paying a month, you know, cumulatively. So,
yeah,
so I didn't see
the
from my
that are
sport,
this into these games would be buying right. The new version every year. Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess I didn't really know who it was, what the audience was for it. And I think to your point, Jeff, like maybe they are testing the water. I think the thing that I would say on more of a business point of view than me as a gamer is like, it's got to be hugely scary for a big company like EA, right? That's a public company. They have revenue from these huge franchises like Madden, like FIFA, but they're sort of looking at the way the market could potentially be changing with like subscription models and, you know, PlayStation Now and PlayStation Plus and Xbox's program. So I can kind of see like they're trying to maybe sort of position themselves so they don't get caught napping if things do change dramatically. But
I think that's the thing, right? I think this story is somewhat intrinsically linked to the PlayStation Now beta going public for PS4 owners. And then you combine that, like you said, David, with, you know, PlayStation Plus or Games for Gold, where it's this big jockeying for, no one wants to be Blockbuster, you know, when they had the opportunity to buy Netflix and didn't, and then Blockbuster went away. It's like, I think people see the writing, so to speak, on the wall for these subscription services or this digital-only approach. And everybody's trying to jockey to figure out which way is the best way. And I don't know if anyone's figured it out quite yet. I think, you know, a lot of gamers are complaining about all of the services. It seems like PlayStation Plus maybe gets the most love. But it's an interesting world where, you know, PlayStation Now is this, the beta is out and around, and it's this thing where I can play games streamed to my console in a way that works pretty seamlessly, but people are just complaining about the pricing instead of, you know, realizing, holy crap, this is the thing that I'm doing. It's like, well, this isn't great because this is stupid and dumb, and oh, EA, why would anyone want to pay? That's stupid and dumb, and oh, great, Microsoft's giving me free games too? Dumb. Oh, when I cancel my PlayStation Plus subscription, I don't get to keep the games? Dumb. It's like this mindset where, like, everybody wants, and then when there's a cost associated with it, it's like, dumb.
Well, I think I don't know what the answer is. It'd be really interesting to see how this does. I mean, there's really no reason for them to have to release any financial information as to how it works. But it's going to be very interesting to see how well this catches on, because I'm relating it to supposedly the – it may have already come out this morning, but supposedly the financial information for the WWE network that they launched recently to try to basically do this kind of thing, pay a subscription to lots of content for a company that usually just puts out $60 monthly products in the form of pay-per-views. And the word on the street is that they did not do well at all. So it's going to be interesting to see if EA figures out a way to crack that nut and if people find the value proposition here to be desirable or not.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. We hope you find our value proposition desirable and that you will take a second and listen to our sponsor, Harry's. They have made this show possible, and we're so excited that they have. Harry's is a revolutionary new way to shave your face. It's super cool. Christian and I both have tried Harry's introductory box, which is really, really cool. So here's what happened. The founder of Harry's, this guy Andy, he went to the drugstore to try to get some products to shave with. He waited 10 minutes for someone to unlock the case where they kept the razors. He bought a 4-pack of blades, some shaving cream, had a hard time dealing, waiting for the dude to come over to unlock the thing, waiting around. And then we left, and he looked into his bag, and he realized he spent over $25 for products and brands they didn't really care about that were just generic. And he really thought there had to be a better way to do this. That's why they started Harry's. Harry's is focused on providing guys with a great shaving experience for a fraction of the price. And the blades are half the price of their competitors, like Gillette, for example. They say less is better, with clean product design, high-quality blades engineered in their own factory in Germany for sharpness and strength, and you order it online. You don't have to bother with going down to the drugstore, and it takes less time than waiting for someone to unlock the case. It ships right to your doors, super convenient, it's slick, it's cool, it's got a great high-quality components and products, and opening it is like opening up your new Apple laptop. It's like, it's cool. So you've experienced this, Christian. What is your feeling?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, it's convenient, and it's kind of, I think I said this last time they sponsored the show, but it's kind of like unboxing an Apple product versus some other products where they put thought into the packaging. And, you know, I think when push comes to shove, the packaging is all well and good, but it works. And it's I just tweeted a picture of my face. I shaved this morning. So yeah, if you are a guy that
you're doing the new clean shaven look, right?
Yeah, I just tweeted a picture of my shaved podcast face. If you are a guy that shaves, I don't see why you wouldn't give this a shot. Really, no ad spin or twist or whatever. Give it a shot. If you don't like it, great. Don't use it ever again.
Well, you know, we're going to help you. We're going to help you give it a shot. We're going to give you $5 off your first purchase if you use our promo code DLC. So go to harrys.com, use the promo code DLC. It's easy to remember. It's the name of our show. We'll give you $5 off your first purchase. Give it a shot. It's something I really dig. It's something you definitely need if you're a dude and you're not growing your massive ZZ Top beard. It's cool, it's awesome, and it's much easier than doing it any other way. We're really excited that Harry's is sponsoring our show. So use that promo code to let them know that you dig our show and you get $5 off. Harrys.com with the promo code DLC.
Can you guys just give me is it H-A-R-R-I-E-S? You totally just sold me on that.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, it's HARRYS.com. I should probably spell that every time. It's as if there was an apostrophe, but there's no apostrophe.
All right.
So it's like Harry owns this. So HARRYS.com. And then DLC is the important part. Put in DLC as the promo code.
I will do. Thanks.
Awesome, dude.
All right.
All right,
that was
Christian.
Worth coming on the show for.
That's really all you're here for. Christian, what is your story of the week?
My story of the week has to be a little bit of my, you know, I'll admit when I had done wrong. It looks like now information is coming out that, quote, Bungie is investing big in Destiny's end game. And last week I was saying, look, I'm excited about Destiny just like the other guy. I've pre-ordered it. But temper
the other guy
expectations.
Being me.
Right, yes. Who's always excited about everything, and so it's easy to say. You actually didn't lose your voice this week from going whitewater rafting, Jeff. You just were playing more Divinity, and that's
that's right. I just yell at my computer alone in my room.
Pure joy.
You're amazing!
But, I mean, the news is coming out that... you know, the end game is hyper, super important to Bungie, and they put a lot of time into it and making the game. And, you know, they have a quote, extremely crafted end game raids. Then some of the pushback on it, though, is that there's not matchmaking for the end game content for these raids. But I think it's cool. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe don't temper your expectations. Let them run wild.
This story
will
was
be amazing.
Submitted by @cunning_Steven on Twitter, among others. And it does sound like they've got this tons of stuff here. He was referring to a story on IGN with an interview with our old buddy Luke Smith, who's now working at Bungie. And you know, if anybody remembers listening to those old podcasts with Luke Smith, he was a huge WoW endgame guy back in the early days of World of Warcraft. And it sounds like he and the team are leveraging the experience that they've had with MMOs in creating this action MMO. What do you think about the details that were revealed? Yes, you had to eat your words that there's something, but now that we know a little bit about what the something is, are you excited about it?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an interesting way. It's an interesting approach on it, right? Like, I'm not a big MMO guy. I have tinkered with WoW, but not even the WoW that exists anymore. You know what I mean? It was the WoW of my youth, which is a totally different game, and I never really explored in-game content. But, you know, from what I've heard about it, I like it, and I like the fact that some of the raids or strikes are shorter missions and not necessarily longer things. And I'm also kind of a fan that there's not matchmaking, because hopefully my hope is then that it's more seamless and you're able to, you know, you're playing and you go into this thing and it kind of picks up and puts people in with you, versus you go to this thing, call up your friends, sit in a lobby. Like, playing with friends is always can make it a unique experience, but I think anything that would break immersion or immediacy would be a distraction if I had to then wait and you're getting paired and that kind of thing.
Oh, Can you explain that to me, Christian? Like, because I read that when I read that it wasn't doing matchmaking, I thought that they were basically saying you have to play with your friends.
Oh, maybe I read it. Yeah. I could be a huge idiot. I thought it was the other way around. I thought it was going to be just random. Yeah.
No. It's the opposite. It's hey, there's so much cooperation right. needed for these that we don't trust that randoms can even get through it. So you need to be so on your game and so working in tandem with each other that we're not supporting the option to just jump into a game with strangers.
Well, this is why we have very smart guests on, and why. So now I change everything I said. This sounds horrible. I'm canceling my pre-order. I totally misskimmed that when I was on the toilet reading on my phone.
So I let me try and get that picture out of my head of you on your phone. My take on Destiny was I didn't play World of Warcraft. I'm one of those guys. And I actually didn't play Halo. I mean, I did. I played the first one all the way through, but I wasn't one of those like Halo guys, right? Where I bought every single one. And I played the Destiny beta and I was all in on it. And like, I loved it. I loved running around in a world where there was other people and I could partner up with someone. I even couldn't figure out how to get the headset to work on my PS4, but managed to sort of communicate with a guy enough that we sort of teamed up and we went through the game together and we're helping each other
out. A series of dances.
Yeah, exactly. Dance moves and a little salute now and then. and it was awesome. And I was actually all in, and I totally never thought there wouldn't be a deep end game. The part that I was disappointed about was when I did read about you that you need to find your friends because like I'm one of these guys that like trying to get six people friends together online at the same time, like I don't even know how I'm gonna do that. Like I have trouble trying to get online the same time as my brother to play some Borderlands 2 co-op, you know, just because that's like six different people living six different lives, right? Like unless you're all in a college dorm together. And maybe that's just the generational thing too. So,
well, maybe
I'm hoping that there's another way around that where people like, I mean, I feel like how did that happen in World of Warcraft? You guys, like, it feels like people made friendships through forming guilds, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that there's going to be structures like that within the game as well. You know, I think there's a name for you can make a guild, But there's also sounds like there's plenty of other things to do that aren't these raids. You know, they have these the bounties that change, and there's the week long bounties and the daily bounties and these strikes, which are the shorter dungeon runs that you can do at end game. So it sounds like they have a pretty robust system of which the raids are just a part.
So there's raids, and then there's the lonely losers option.
Well, the thing that makes
what are you doing today? You want to play Destiny? No, I'll be playing by myself. I got some bounties to collect.
Well, you won't even be having that conversation because there's nobody to talk to.
My conversation will be, man, these raids are awesome. I love that there aren't this is so – oh, wait, I'm not doing the raids. I had the information totally wrong about this game. Oh, wait, I've been playing Titanfall this whole time. I have everything wrong.
Well, the cool thing about all this info is that it sounds like these raids are going to be really difficult. And the challenge is going to be really high, and it's going to be the kind of thing where you whittle away at it, just like the early old hard raids in WoW, where you'd go in and you'd be able to take down one boss, and that would be a multi-hour project. And then you'd be like, okay, well, let's come back. You know, we got figured out that boss. Let's come back, you know, next week and try the next boss. I'm really, really excited about this. I'm particularly excited that they're thinking about it in a way that is unique to a raid in an MMO. So they're not just layering on MMO mechanics. They're really thinking about it as, hey, we're doing a game where you jump, shoot, and have abilities. How does that play into a team-based takedown of a boss? How do we still maintain everyone having a role to play in a game where you're used to being the, you know, the Rambo, the super soldier. I just think it's a really cool way to rethink the genre, and I'm very excited to see how these things come together. I have a, I mean, I think that Destiny was pretty much my story of the week as well.
Yes.
It really
Eat
was.
It, Jeff. Eat it.
It's the one I'm most excited about. We have a few other things.
I should have let you have it because you were also the one that was more informed.
Yeah, you're like, my story of the week, I didn't really read.
No, I totally did. I had it. I honestly cannot, one, not afraid to admit totally wrong. Two, I really can't believe I had it totally backwards because I read it and I was like, this is great. This is for me. This is how I game. I just want to get in, pick up, meet friends, go do something awesome together, have this random chance encounter. And now
you
I'm
want the
like,
Tinder of video games. That's what you
always
want.
Always swipe right, bro.
So another thing that just popped up this morning, I believe, was the announcement of BioShock for iOS, which was submitted by several people, including at ICU and at Great White. This is pretty interesting. So BioShock, way back in the day, way back in 2008, a year after BioShock was released, they said, hey, we're making an iPhone version of BioShock. And similarly to how they said, we're making a Vita version of BioShock, they said that and then it never happened. But evidently there is an iOS version of BioShock. It's coming soon. It has been shown playable. It is in no way related to that project. I guess it was a new version or new iteration of this idea. But it's for iPad, and it is pretty much an exact replica of the original BioShock, the original 2007 BioShock, with just some slightly reduced graphics. But it kind of shows how far pads have come, how far tablets have come. Because you can play this game with the touchscreen, although I hate virtual sticks, so I don't know if I would do that. But it also supports the M-Fi controller, so you can play it with a controller. So that's kind of cool. What do you think about this, David?
Does it have virtual sticks? I looked at the preview. I could see some different weapon buttons, but...
Yeah, it does. It has that little circle that pops up. When you put your thumb down, yeah. It's got that little circle that pops up that shows where you're, you know, which direction you're leaning.
It probably depends on where, like if it's specifically you have to put press right on this button to move, or I've seen other versions where wherever on screen you press the button, it'll kind of pick from there and then you move up or down.
Right. Either way, though, I hate it.
Okay. I think it's really tough, right? Like 2K have done a pretty good job, I feel, of like bringing some of their bigger games over, like XCOM. Right. Did you play that, Jeff?
Yeah. But that game works really well on a tablet. You know, I think turn based games are particularly effective on a touchscreen device because you can take your time and make a decision and then just touch where you want.
Yeah. So it's funny. This is something we've actually been thinking about a lot at Dynamite too, because. You know, Counterspy plug is also going to be coming out on iOS. There's going to be a version that's going to be launching that's sort of a lot of the same core gameplay. And so we spent a lot of time thinking about how to create a enjoyable action experience on touch. And the first thing we did was just get away with virtual sticks at all.
Yeah.
Smart. So I definitely think like if you can do it without virtual sticks, you should. I don't know. It's weird. Like I don't know if do people want to sit on their phone and their tablet and play games the way they do on their console?
I guess that's
one question I have.
I don't think so, but I personally don't. I mean, I like the fact that there are big, deep media experiences like XCOM, like Civilization Revolution, that there are really cool big games, but I don't know if I'd want to play the original BioShock on a pad. I don't know.
Did you guys play Dead Space on the iPad?
I think you did, right, Christian? Didn't you play that, Christian?
Yeah. I did. It was one of those things where, for me, it was like that first technical or graphical stunner on the iPad. Mm-hmm. And it was like, this is amazing. They can do it. Oh my gosh. The lines are blurring. Is this console? Is this mobile? And then I played the first level. I was like, this isn't fun. and I put it down. I think, you know, I don't know who this game is for, BioShock iOS. I really don't. I don't think it's I don't think someone that is just a mobile tablet, phone, threes, or, you know, even some of the Hearthstone gamer is like, finally, I can play this game from 2006, 2007, whatever it is, and like get this experience. And I don't think people that have had the experience are like, finally, I can play this on my iPad wherever I go. I feel like where iOS gaming is shining is stuff that's made for it, like Hearthstone, that uses its strengths and weaknesses. And I think some console games can be ported over and be more successful in that world, like an XCOM or that style of game. But I just don't understand this, aside from the fact that, oh, maybe it was easy to do and we can make some money off of it. I think the bean counters looked at it and said, green light, and they're making it.
Yeah, I also think I'm not a very big believer in the sort of sticker pad onto the side of your device to play the game either.
Yeah,
right. You know, like
or like clip a controller or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. David, you mentioned having another story that you wanted to bring up. What was that?
Oh, so I have one which is kind of a lead into a discussion that I thought would be interesting to put to you guys, and it was. Based on a story that ran on Polygon, it was an interview with the developer of Banner Saga, which was a pretty awesome game that was successfully kickstarted, like a strategy RPG. Certainly the type of game I think that does fit tablet well. But they were talking about why they decided to launch on Steam first and then bring it to iPad. One of the things they said that was interesting that I saw other people pick up on was that they said Apple is frustrated with kind of the amount of free-to-play content that is crowding out sort of more premium pricing on tablet and iPhone. And they want... I think his quote, I think, was they want more quality. Trying to find the actual quote so I'm not misquoting.
That's okay.
Apple is frustrated along with everybody else about the mentality that's gone rampant in mobile app markets where people don't want to pay anything. Okay, that was the quote I pulled. So here's the thing, right? Like, you're Apple, like... If you're frustrated, like, there's a lot that you could do with the store to really kind of like encourage discovery of games that are awesome that you think people should pay in. And I think they do a lot. They curate the feature section of the store. And I think they do a lot of good stuff there. But this is sort of a general, not just Apple, but like all the platform holders. I think one of the things that I would love to see happen is just more discovery, like a better way to find me games that I want to play, right? Like, I have types of games I want to play. Like, help me find them. Is this something you guys have any thoughts on?
Yeah, I do. I definitely feel like this is a major problem with the App Store. I'm a outspoken critic of iTunes altogether, and I think the App Store is an example of just sort of lackluster design from a company who prides itself on design. Steam does this better, but they also are about to get to this tipping point where there's just so much stuff coming out all the time that it's hard to even sift through it and know what's good and what isn't. I think if somebody really figured it out and cracked that nut of the App Store of filtering the best stuff to the top, of filtering really quality, great games, I don't think it's just a matter of ratings, because I feel like ratings in the App Store are really misleading in a lot of ways and are not particularly helpful. I think there really needs to be a strong push on the store side, on the operator's side, to either curate the content or just figure out a better OS, a better UI is the word I was looking for, a better UI to assist gamers in figuring out or you know, app buyers in a way of finding out what's the good stuff.
But it's tough, right? I mean, first, I think Apple tried, and I don't know if they're still trying, but what Matt, I'm going to say his last name wrong, Casamassina, he worked for IGN. He was a Nintendo guy. They hired him in like 2010 or 11, and it was like he was going to go over to do something for the Apple App Store game side of things. I can look that up as I continue to blab. But it's tough because I think both sides are really difficult, right? If you have this curated great experience, like, you know, David Counterspy, I've been excited about the game since I saw it at E3. I have it pre-ordered and set to go. But like, let's say, you know, Sony, you know, we'll pick a totally different game, your next game, right? Comes out and next game is awesome and the best game you think you've ever made. And it goes out on the PlayStation Network or on the App Store, but doesn't get featured in any way, shape, or form, or in this highly curated Steam storefront. Mm. It's like, that's disappointing because you think you've made this amazing thing and people just need to find it. But, I think from a creator standpoint, that's frustrating in that super highly curated world that you don't get your stuff surfaced to the front. Like, you're the thing.
Yeah, it becomes a gatekeeper. It's a gatekeeper at that point. It's like you have to... You have to be on the list or no one notices you. And I get that, but I think there's ways to avoid that too.
Well, I think from the user perspective, though, it also can be viewed as a negative. Like when you log into Netflix now, it's almost a struggle to find other things that are there versus the stuff that they just push so much stuff to the top. It's like, oh, hey, welcome to Netflix. By the way, apparently all that's on Netflix, unless you search for it, is Orange is the New Black, Lilyhammer, Hemlock Grove and Avengers or whatever it is, you know, right? Like it just, you push all this stuff forward and then it feels like this closed environment where you don't get to find the stuff you want to find. And I don't know, I think some genius will crack this. Like you said, we'll crack the nut and figure it out. But I don't know which side I'm on because I look at both sides of this argument and I kind of don't like either world.
Yeah.
So I have two approaches that I've been thinking, and this is me. Like, I'm not technical, so I'm the idiot that doesn't know how hard these problems are, right? But clearly they are very hard problems to solve because there's so many companies that have storefronts. I feel like there's two things that I think about. One is I would love to live in a world where all that game information and data that you're getting about me that's being stored on servers is put to use to sort of push content back to me. So take, for example, like you know, whoever you are, if you're at, let's say Apple, right? Apple knows, I assume, they know what games I've downloaded and paid for. They also know what games I've played and how long I've played them for. Or at least if they don't, like I would... I think this is one of the things where it's an example of like privacy versus like, I would like them to know that information.
Right.
And if they knew everybody's information, they'd go, hey, you and 10,000 other people played these six games all the way to the end. And here's the seventh game that the other 9,999 games people played. So you'll probably like it too. Like aggregate all that data in some big crazy spreadsheet.
Yeah, it's
like,
funny because people want it both ways. They're like, don't take my data, don't watch me, I don't want to feel watched. And then on the other hand, they're like, how come it tells me I want this game when I have no desire for that? It's so dumb about the suggestions it's making. It's like, well, you kind of have to supply it with info for it to make informed suggestions to you.
Yeah. And I think the you're right about user ratings. I think like whatever the solution is, it needs to be something that's sort of passive, because you don't even know necessarily what games you're going to like. You discover gems all the time and you find things like I fell in love with FTL, example, so and got totally obsessive about it. But it sort of, if you looked at my gaming history, you wouldn't go, oh, here's the guy that played all these action games. FTL's the game for him.
Yeah.
So the other approach, which I think Steam have sort of talked about this, which I think is intriguing, is the idea of individual curation, where I almost feel like the other way I'd want to go is have like the way Twitter works, where I go, all right, here's a bunch of people who I am interested in following, I'm interested in knowing what game Christian's playing or buying or just selecting, like what's Christian's top five,
right?
What's so-and-so's top five? Like there's a bunch of sort of influencers or people, you know, like, hey, I want to know what Ken Levine's digging this month.
Yeah.
And then I have like maybe a bunch of people that I'm following that have those lists exposed.
I think that's a really cool
that
idea.
Would help me.
I really do. I think that's awesome. I would like that. I would like to go to Christian's storefront, you know, and see, but that, you know, that, and that just kind of bubbles up instead of bubbling up individual games, you're bubbling up people who seem to be the most helpful, you know?
Yeah. Cause you kind of gravitate towards you, people who have similar tastes that you like. Like I know I follow people on Twitter cause I'm like, oh, that they post interesting stories. So, you know, I like to see what they're posting. So I feel like for me, at least something like that, where other people are providing some curation for me would be awesome.
It's almost as if it was somebody's playlist. Huh? Is that a good segue into our next segment? It's time for the playlist. Ooh, what you playing this?
Zach is on point. I was really hoping that he would just leave you hanging and have you keep forcing the segue, huh? The playlist, the list of the ones we play.
I feel really smart at how I teed that one up for
that
you.
That was brilliant, David. You're a pro. I appreciate that. Before I even get to you guys, I want to hop into a couple of callers because we have a few callers on the line here. They've been waiting quite a while. So there is somebody from 413 area code. What's your name? Where are you calling from? And what's on your playlist this week?
Hi, I'm Nate. I'm calling from Massachusetts. I started playing Divinity 2, the director's cut.
Oh, interesting.
Because Everybody's been talking about Original Sin, so I need to get to that eventually.
And do you like it?
It takes place before it, obviously. I do, yeah. I'm about an hour into it or so. The world is so big, and it just seems really cool. Like, there's a lot of stuff to do. I'm going to need to, like, get out, like, a block of time where I can sit down and really get into it.
Yeah, so you
and,
do recommend
it? Other than that, I also... yeah, so far, definitely.
Cool.
I love those, like, European RPGs.
Right. Anything else on your playlist this week?
I actually just started getting back to World War II.
I think you kind of cut out there a little bit. What was that?
Since, like, sorry. I said I just getting back into Guild Wars 2.
Yes.
I play it off and on every few months, and, you know, every time I come back, there's so much more to learn and everything, and I just love the living story stuff they do where the world, like, changes, like, permanently. And they're always adding new quests for no additional cost and everything. It's great.
Yeah, I played a ton of Guild Wars 2 when it first released and really dug it. I kind of moved on to other MMOs as I do. But, I still get emails of, like, the crazy content updates, and everyone talks about how great a game it continues to be. And yet I don't go back to it, even though it doesn't require a monthly fee. So maybe I'll have to dip back into that. But I think it's also cool that people will take the moment of hype about a particular game to go back and play its predecessor, you know, to say, oh, everybody's all excited about this game. Let me play the earlier game in the franchise. I think that's kind of cool, too.
I think that's interesting. And I guess it's a good game. It's a good game, but it's always... My battle is always, do I need to play this earlier game to understand this later game?
Because it's almost always no.
Right. And so then I tend my gameplay style, and I don't think there's a right or wrong way. I mean, if you don't do it the way I do it, I hate you as a person. But the way I do it is I want to dive into the newest, latest, best. Like, oh, this new game is awesome and best and everybody loves it. Then I'm going to play that one versus
I'm that way too.
Go wade through the old one.
Yeah.
Well, we're still friends for today, then, Jeff.
David, what is on your playlist?
So we already talked about Destiny Beta, which I did play that weekend. I also finished Wolfenstein, but I know you guys have talked about that a ton.
Are you
no,
but
in.
I just put myself on the pile of people who say that was an awesome game. And if you like first-person shooters, don't sleep on that game. And it's really important. I think like games like that, that come along, that you can just tell so much passion and heart went into it, and works on so many levels. It's like, you know, support that game with your dollars. That will help that developer have the opportunity to make more games like that. Right. So that's me putting my game developer hat on. But, and then the other game, which I think, Christian, you've probably been playing, two, is Rogue Legacy.
There it is. There it is. 2013's game of the year, according to Jeff Cannata.
My God. So, my experience with it. So I hadn't played it before. I think it was out before on Steam, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, but who cares? And until it's on Vita, it's not born, so, if you ask me.
Oh, man. Super hard. Really punishing. Stick at it if you pick it up. And you just kind of, it just gets better and better. So I've been spending a lot of time playing that. And it's interesting, too, because, you know, Counter-Spy has a lot of procedural elements to the game. And so it's interesting to see how another game approached stuff and things that they were able to do and problems that they were able to solve that were kind of different, because they are very different types of games. And so there are different decisions that got taken along the way. So from a design point of view, it's always interesting. And I think, you know, you will often find people talk about this, like you try and put your game design brain, turn that off when you're playing a game like this. Or something, you know, to not overanalyze it.
Right,
but,
right.
I've been enjoying it.
Christian, have you been playing? Did you play Rogue Legacy originally on Steam or no?
I did not. It was not. I'm not the biggest of PC gamers. And pretty much right after it came out on Steam, they said they were going to do a Vita version. It took them, I think, longer than they initially announced, but that got me to hold off on it. So I dove in as part of the PS Play. I think I might have pre-ordered all of those games. dude, do you have a Vita, Jeff?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I'm not. I know you have mastered this game, and I know it's $15 or whatever it is, but I think it plays so well on the Vita, and the cross-save functionality for me has been seamless so far, but I find myself, even at home, preferring to play on the Vita just because it's perpetually in sleep mode. It's just a real quick wake up. I play through a couple of lives, you know, put it back in sleep mode, and I can do it. It's just so quick to pick up and play and dive in. And I'm sure, as you gushed about last year, it's, you know, really smart in terms of the load times are very quick.
Yeah.
In terms of you die, and then you pick your new heir, and then you go. I don't, maybe someone did this in the PC version, but all I can think about is trying to create like an automate tasks and see if I can crash the game. Like, how many heirs can I have? Because when you die, it shows you your lineage, right?
Yeah.
Like, I wonder if the game is going to run out of memory on me. Because there, and I think Garnet was a guest on when he was playing it on PC too, or maybe we talked about it off air. But like, it's a thing where it's, so if you don't know anything about the game, right, it's random, procedurally generated dungeons. And then when your character dies, you pick an heir in the lineage, and then you go back into the dungeon, except barring an unlock that you get later, the layout of the dungeon in the world is completely different. The types of enemies are often the same, and you're populating that world. But like, you get this false sense of confidence, right? Like, there'll be times where I start on my next heir, and I go into a room, and I'm like, one skeleton throwing bones, one little ice explodey guy died. Son of a, like, you get lazy, or you try to rush through it. Like, okay, I got to get to the first teleporter. I'm going to set things up. I'm going to be, son of a, okay, this time I'm going to really take, are you kidding me? But that's where the quick reload, it's painfully difficult, but not frustratingly difficult, which I think is important for this style of game. And I like the fact, too, that it's procedurally generated, or, you know, each time the dungeon is different, because to me, I think that makes it almost less frustrating than I can't get past this certain level or this certain stage is always where I die. Right. You never know where you're going
to
die.
Exactly. Yeah, you're not butting your head up against a wall unless you want to, unless you choose to, which is great.
I think the key thing, definitely with what Christian was saying, is just how fast they're able to get you back into the game. It's probably one of the things because of the graphics are so simple, right? Everything can just be kind of reloaded and get you right back into it as fast as possible. So I would have a ton of areas where I would die in some pretty frustrating way. But before I've even had this sort of opportunity to finish screw this game, I'm out. I've already hit the button to restart, right, and I'm already picking my character for the new journey. I also thought that was a really clever sort of innovation, like the idea of having your heirs and you inherit the cash and the stuff that you're leveling up. Right. I thought that was kind of a very clever hook.
Yeah, death is a benefit. You get what new crazy quirk do I get to choose this time rather than a frustration? And also, you know, I agree with you. I think that load time is directly proportional to frustration for me. It's punitive when I have to wait to get back into the game. And when a game just lets me pop right back in after doing something stupid, I don't feel like I did something stupid because it wasn't that big of a deal. So I think that's key as well. I basically played this game as if it were a Vita game when I played it, because I played it on my laptop with a Xbox 360 controller plugged in and played it on the plane, brought it around with me. Like, it was, I manufactured my own mobile gaming version of this. And the fact that it's now on an actual awesome mobile gaming device, the only reason I don't already own it is because I haven't been in town this weekend.
I wish there were pictures of people's like looks that they were giving you on the plane. I picture you as like that. You were like the 90s kid, like, you know, you drank a Go-Gurt and then you're like, and you can play games on the go with my laptop and controller. I can take my games anywhere.
It's so easy. Just plug your laptop in, carry your portable controller, use the cord over here and wrap it around you.
And everything fits in this rolly bag that's just a little too big to be carry-on.
Exactly. Oh, man.
I have to say about one thing about travel, like as painful as getting on a plane always is, like, do you remember when your opportunities for gaming was just, oh, hey, look, I can hold this like TV remote and there's little puzzly games in the back of the TV that's half broken on this flight I'm on, and I can the fact that you can pull out pretty much any machine now and just play a game, I think. Talking about more core action games, like I remember when Vice City came out on iPhone, that was a game that I played all the way through, and it was because I was trapped on a lot of international travel. Like I was on like a 14-hour flight, and I was like, oh my God, I can just sit down. I'm here. I'm playing Vice City on a flight. Like, it was just crazy.
Well, I guess that's the argument in favor of BioShock on an iPad, right? Maybe that is that for somebody that didn't play the game in 2007. They're like, oh, I can finally play through this classic that people have been telling me about because I can play it on the go.
Right. So for 14-hour flights,
yeah,
it's recommended. Right?
Exactly. Be sure to charge your devices, kids.
Going after.
Yeah. Christian, anything else you've been playing?
So I took the plunge into PlayStation Now. I wanted to check out check out the experience, the beta on the PS4, and I played Mutant Blobs, which I've already played through on Vita, which is an excellent game. It's Drinkbox Studios. If you haven't played it, I would play it. And it was free I don't know if it's free for everybody. I didn't ask. Is it free for everyone? ? It was free. Maybe it's free for me because I own it, but I hadn't played it on the console or whatever. And man, I'll tell you what. Yeah, this week I got a little angry at people just being so, like, I'm the pessimist. Don't out-pessimist me, internet.
I never underestimate the pessimism of the internet.
I know. Apparently I did. It's like this service comes out. It's in beta. And yeah, I agree. The pricing model doesn't win you over with sunshine and puppies and flowers and candy. But like, if it's too expensive for you, don't use it. Just leave it at that. Like, I don't think you need to complain and moan and hope that it fails and this is the worst thing ever, and it's just like, just move on, it's not for you. Or look at the positive side of things, where this thing is cool. And it's just kind of like, the same thing is true of EA Access. And I'm not trying to be a Sony fanboy or Microsoft fanboy. I think it was cool when it was its own company. But it's like this thing works where I am playing a game that's somewhere else that's beaming to my house magically. And I'm sitting holding a wireless remote away from my TV that's an inch thick. And it's like one of these moments where, nah, it's not the holodeck, but dang it, this is the future. And at some point, that price model will work out to be successful and a viable business proposition. And then that's awesome. Like, we're taking those steps. We're experiencing it. We're watching NASA build the lunar rover that lands on the moon. And I think it's maybe it's my tech whiz-bang, fun, awesome thing that are putting these rose-colored glasses on. Will I pay at any of the current prices? No. Oh, God, no. It's too expensive.
I ain't paying for you walking on the moon.
No, I'm not. Yeah, I'm not going to pay for that, but I will watch it and I will appreciate it happening.
Enjoy it for free. I love the hypocrisy inherent in your statement.
That's the bigger problem, though, that maybe might need to hold over till next week or something, or we can get the conversation going. I almost said join the conversation online.
Tifford in the forum just mentioned this. I was totally looking for a link for that Louis C.K. sketch.
Yeah.
You know, where he talks about everything is amazing and we're not happy.
Yeah, yeah, with a cell phone. Like, why is my cell phone taking four extra seconds right to contact space and beam my words around the world?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. But I think potentially the bigger problem on the pricing issue is the I'll float this hypothesis out there. Is the console spaces a version of the free game on the App Store, right? What's going to be the race to the bottom is this subscription service model where we're currently getting so much for so little money that people are going to balk at things that are more expensive. You know, Netflix has this problem every time they try to raise their prices. And it's like, wait a minute, I already get the universe for $8 a month. You want me to pay $12 a month to watch every show? I'm being overly broad here, that's ever been created to get it. Oh, Amazon, I have to pay $10 more a year to get free 2-day shipping plus your streaming service. Get out.
I would take umbrage with some how far you're going on this rant and saying, like, just accept whatever a company decides to charge you and be grateful that you get it. It's like, no, you have to make your own value propositions. If that is more expensive than you want to pay for that service, then cease paying for it. That's perfectly fine.
It is, but I think the problem that companies got into is they launched these things at cheaper prices than they could have, and now they've set a floor for what we expect it to be, and they're realizing, holy crap, this content is expensive. We thought we could get people in, get them addicted, and then, you know, juice them up. The first hit is free, and I think they're running into that problem. And now the problem is, you know, Sony, it's great. Don't get me wrong. It's great for consumers, but like Sony and Microsoft and everybody's in this race for giving you free stuff, games for gold, PlayStation Plus, where now, you know, great games come out on the PSN and people are like, well, I'm not going to buy it because it'll be free for Plus, you know, 6 months from now. Or why buy this game when I'm getting two games I haven't played already for free? I'll check out Fez this month because I never got around to it, so I won't buy Rogue Legacy. And it's an interesting business world we're entering. And Jeff, dang it, agree with me.
I will not, ever.
I will agree with elements of what you're saying, Christian. I got your back.
Thank you.
I think, so I'm pretty optimistic by nature, or at least try to be. And so I think that the thing that's exciting for me about a service like PlayStation Now is they have such a rich back catalog of amazing games going back to the PlayStation, and there's so many people who haven't maybe experienced them, and they're hard to get now. And so if there's a way for you to be able to discover amazing old games through PlayStation Now, like, I think that's awesome. Then as a person making video games, you know, I think the overall trend of things like the subscription service that EA is doing, you know, like all these things that you're speaking to, there's just a lot of uncertainty, right? And so I don't know yet how that all ends up netting out for people like us, right? Like, because there's the big companies that are building huge businesses, and whether they're publishers or platform holders, And then there's the sort of independent studios that are out there making games, you know. And so what I would hate to see is to see something like what you've seen in the music industry, where you've got services like Spotify, which, again, awesome service. Like, I use it all the time. And I find a lot of music that I wouldn't find otherwise. But I know that a lot of that money, a very small portion of that money, makes its way back to the artists. You know, so I'll actually consciously go out and buy the, you know, the music when I find something I really like. But, you know, I know that that's, you know, not everyone is necessarily going to feel compelled to do that. So I suppose it's just, yeah, it's a complicated question.
Yeah, for sure. Let's take another call. There's somebody on the line from 661. What is your name? Where are you calling from? And what is on your playlist this week?
Hi, this is Michael calling from Amsterdam. What's on my playlist this week? This week, I actually finished Star Fox 64 on the Nintendo 3DS for the first time ever.
Are you calling from 1997?
Apparently, I am. Yeah, yeah.
I probably got the date of that very
unfortunately
wrong.
Unfortunately for me, back in the day, I'm ashamed to say that I am a Nintendo fan, but I skipped on the N64 era. So, yeah, I missed out on a lot of games, and Ocarina of Time was one of them, and I didn't finish that game until it came out on the 3DS as well.
Did you play it on an actual N64, or did you play it emulated?
3DS.
No, I played it on the 3DS.
Yes, yeah. Right, so emulated. Yeah, well, that's cool. I guess he already said that and I missed it.
Well, it's not emulated per se, right? I mean, it's a remaster of sorts.
It's remade. Yeah. It's remade.
All right. So, what did you think? Did it live up to the legend?
Well, the first time I played through it, I went through the easy boss mode, and I was like, oh, okay, well, was that? Wait, I think there was something else. And then the second time, I played through it the other way around, and actually got the real ending. And I was like, okay, that's actually pretty satisfying. So, yeah, I wasn't disappointed.
It's very cool. I love the idea of you know, playing the classics, man. I think that's cool. And I think, Christian, you and I both suffer from Cult of the New status. Me probably more than you do. But I dig that people can go back and play those. I guess reissues on the new shiny handhelds make it a little better to be able to do that. And maybe that's...
I'm sorry, Jeff.
What?
I wasn't listening. I'm already listening to next week's podcast. It's a good one.
Awesome. Oh, man. Well, I guess looking at my watch, I guess it's tabletop time.
Right now.
All right. David, it looks like you played a really new kind of slick, cool tabletop game called Dungeon Dice. Tell me about your experience playing that.
Okay, yeah. So I'm totally a total noob at tabletop gaming. I played a little bit of D&D back in the day, but like I've been basically sucked into it by a few of the guys at work. So I have a good... there's a guy, Ryan, here that's really good at kind of talking us through gently the rules. So I had no idea how new this game was. I knew there'd been a Kickstarter, but yeah, Dungeon Dice. So here's what I can tell you. It's a really fun game for four people to sit around a gaming table, drink whiskey, try and figure out what you're doing. Two of us had never played it before, and the other two had. So, but basically you have a, I guess it's kind of like a questing, RPG mm-hmm. battle game, but with dice instead of cards.
Right.
And you have different set of dice that do different things. Jeff, have you played this game?
I have. Yeah. It's,
okay.
It's pretty cool. Actually. It's this, it's a game that, as you said, is trying to give you the full dungeon crawling D&D type experience, but simulating everything with dice, which basically means it's wildly random. So you are rolling dice to find out what monsters are down in the dungeon. You're rolling dice to find out what they might be carrying. You're rolling dice to find out what your attacks do. You're rolling dice to find out if you can get loot from those things. You're rolling dice for everything. And it's pretty cool. It comes with a lot of really original custom-made dice. It's got custom-made dice, right? It's got all these cool, like, a monster is a die, and it's got a, you know, tells you what, how badass the monster is, and you know, what it might be carrying, what it can do to you. And so I found myself, when I was playing it, probably like you guys, constantly consulting the little glossary of images to find out the key, to find out what the heck this symbol means on this die. So it wasn't super intuitive. It's pretty a complicated game too. I wouldn't say it's a newbie friendly. There are other games that do the same thing. A game called Dungeon Roll does the same thing, but is much simpler and easy, almost too simple, I would say. Dungeon Roll is fun. It's a game I own, but it's almost solitaire. You can play it by yourself because there's so few things to keep track of. But did you have a good time playing Dungeon Dice?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've been kind of getting drawn back into more tabletop gaming. And I think the thing about it that was fun about this game and probably gaming in general is it's being with a group of people, playing the game, talking. So this game has a lot of you can before you get into combat, you can try and enlist someone else into your party, but you have to sort of trade, like you have to offer them something. So it encourages a lot of that, like, hey, why don't you come and help me do this, and I'll give you one of my things. And so there's like a lot of that pre combat bartering that's going on back and forth between players.
Yeah. That's fun.
And it also, I sort of on a more general basis, like I feel like things like tabletop gaming, also like things like local co-op. It's what I feel is sort of happening on a more general basis. I don't know what you guys think about this, is there's this sort of trend back to sort of more local personal gaming experiences, right? Where for so long, all our social experiences were like Facebook and online gaming, where we're sort of thousands of miles away. And I love seeing things like local co-op games. And I think tabletop gaming is another example of that, where people can kind of come together, crack a few beers, and enjoy themselves.
For sure. That is exactly what I love about it. The interpersonal human moment of sitting across the table from somebody and learning how to play something and chatting it up. It's great. I see that the Gru here in the chat room asked if this game is similar to something like Quarriors. And it's the same idea in the sense that it's taking mechanics that you usually see in a card form and putting them on dice, so that it kind of is reminiscent of that. Also reminiscent of Marvel Dice Masters, which I've talked about on the show a bunch of times. I think both of those games are a little bit – I would prefer them to this particular one for giving that cool dice rolling experience. But this is an interesting mechanic. And like you said, it does have that thing where it's like, oh, I know I can't take down this monster, so I need to ask your help, which is sort of like Munchkin in a lot of ways, where you have to figure out ways that you can entice someone to help you out without making them benefit too much, because you're kind of competing with them at the same time. It's got some cool mechanics. I dig it. Christian, you, sir, have been playing a board game. Is this correct?
All full disclosure, I got sent a free copy of a board game and felt then peer pressure to check it. No. I did get it's called Knee Jerk from Knapsack Games, and I got sent a copy. And, you know, people that listen to this show don't listen to me during this segment of the show much. I'm not a big tabletop gamer. But, you know, I'm always willing to check something out that doesn't take much time or commitment from me. And, I played a little bit with my wife and brother-in-law when they were here, and I'm going to describe it poorly, but it's kind of like Cards Against Humanity in the sense that it's a card-based quick playing. A game can be done in 10 seconds or 15 seconds for a round or whatever. And you have a bunch of cards and one person plays as the host. And there's like a phrase or sentence. And then the first person to give their knee jerk, hence the game, reaction to it that can complete the sentence, you know, wins the point. And then the host can, if it, there's a tie, the host picked which one they liked best. And when we were playing it, honestly, we probably weren't playing by the rules, and we all just kind of completed our own. It's kind of the way Cards goes, where we just create funny things and we sit around and laugh at them. We didn't have tons of time to play. My in-laws were just here. They were bringing their daughter to Disney for the first time, so they stopped over and spent the night on their way down. But, you know, it seems like the type of game that if you like a card or that quick playing card, you know,
party game,
we're all having around. Party yeah. game, having drinks. I think it could serve that purpose. I think, you know, I'll bring it over, Jeff. We can check it out, and you can dissect the actual the way you really play it, and or whatever. But I'll spend more time with it. I like quick games like that. I don't think, much like even Cards, it won't pull me away from wanting to spend time on my Vita or on my PS4 or, you know, consuming another type of media. But if you're interested in that type of game, check it out. It's called Knee Jerk, and it's from Knapsack Games.
Very cool. That's awesome that you tried it. And I definitely think there's room for those kind of fun, quick, easy party games. So often you'll have a group of people and, you know, the mood of the experience isn't to sit down and learn something complicated, and they just want to have an excuse to laugh. And there's tons of games like that are excellent. So yeah, I'm excited to check that out. And it sounds like it doesn't skew quite as blue as Cards Against Humanity. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. Correct. Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, Cards doesn't have to skew that blue either, Jeff. But I mean, some of the new card packs certainly do.
I'm sorry.
When that game first
came, I'm pretty sure it skews pretty darn blue. If I have to explain to people what a term that you would never want to Google is, then I'm it's not my fault it went blue.
Well, maybe my copy of the game is different. The backs of our cards are all black.
What? Oh, I get it. I get it. I get it. You're just like, it's just complete. Hey guys, the sentence.
come see me, guys. Come see me do stand-up comedy, you guys, with jokes like that. Come check it out.
Amazing.
This is the worst, like, ad for my comedy career, this whole show.
It's a guy who doesn't understand things. It's this character he's created, but a guy who misunderstands everything. Yeah, well, I have had very little to contribute this week because I've been away, and I apologize for that. But I'll be back next week with lots of experiences. I'm excited to play some more games and do some more stuff. But I really appreciate, David, I appreciate you being on the show this week.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I didn't get to tell you my story about how I, George Lucas and P. So I'm going to throw that out there as a teaser for a future segment.
Oh, and now we have to have you back. Got to get.
Looks like someone just left their keys over at a girl's place.
By the way, that's the worst leave behind ever. Leave your keys. You're like, I have to come back immediately. I can't get into my house.
I don't know if it's the title of this episode, but it's definitely the theme of Christian gets crap wrong.
I left my keys. Oh man, it was so familiar. That girl has to see me again. I'm.
You go down to your car. You can't get in. You immediately come back.
Amazing. Well, on that note, let's reiterate again, David, please, about Counter Spy and when it's coming out and how people can find it.
August 19th on all PlayStation platforms. It's cross-buy, so just pick it up for whatever platform you want. There is a pre-order because it's part of the Play program. And if you're listening in Europe, it's August 20th.
Very cool. Again, that's Counter Spy, and it's on the PlayStation platforms. And it's coming to iOS, right? It's coming to Android as well later in the summer?
Yeah. Yes, there's going to be iOS and Android versions later as well. Cool.
Christian, for people that have not been put off by your behavior this episode, what are you doing?
Oh, man. I run a great show in Los Angeles called Improv versus Stand-Up. It's at UCB. It's the second Thursday of the month, August show. We have Improv by Del Farr, which is Seth Morris and Charlie Sanders, who are two phenomenal improvisers. And then Stand-Up from Joe Wengert, whose Comedy Central half-hour special was just on last month. And Barry Rothbart, who, among other things, was one of the really fun, funny office characters in Wolf of Wall Street, one of those real jerky men, and among other stand-up comedy performances. And then I have a stand-up comedy podcast on the Nerdist Network called What's New? You can check it out and actually see real jokes versus colors, the back of cards against colors. Mr. Cannata, what's popping for you this
week?
Well,
I'm really digging people checking out We Have Concerns, the new show that I'm doing with Anthony Carboni. You can find that at wehaveconcerns.com or wherever you download fine podcasts. It's a comedy show, only 20 minutes long, three times a week. I hope you guys check it out. I've been getting great feedback on that. Also, / Filmcast. We're about to record our Guardians of the Galaxy episode, so you won't want to miss that. I am a regular on the / Filmcast now over at slashfilm.com, and you can already see my video review of Guardians of the Galaxy if you go to my YouTube page. That's youtube.com/KanataJeff. So that's going to do it this week. I will rest up and hope my voice recovers, and we will be back next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific time. You can listen live and call in live if you're around at those times. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.